Hello, this is On Science, a weekly podcast from NPR Science Desk. I'm Dan Charles. This week, our stories come from all over. We report on discoveries at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico, in Africa, and from inside our own brains. But the strangest development involves a bacteria that's able to use the deadly poison arsenic in place of an element previously considered essential for life. As NPR's John Hamilton reports, the finding defies scientific dogma, and it appears to expand the range of places where life could exist, on Earth or on distant planets yet to be discovered.
The discovery comes from a young astrobiologist at NASA who likes to find exceptions to rules. Felisa Wolf-Simon says she was fascinated by crustaceans because they don't use iron to carry oxygen around their bodies the way most species do. Instead, they substitute copper. And Wolf-Simon thought this sort of chemical substitution might go even further.
What about the main building blocks of life? Carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur. Can we substitute any of those? And the dogma is no.
That's because all known forms of life need those six elements. But Wolf-Simon started thinking about phosphorus and the element just below it on the periodic table, arsenic.
Arsenic is toxic because it looks like phosphorus, so your cells and my cells and microbial cells can't tell the difference.
Until they try to actually use arsenic and die. Still, she thought evolution has produced an incredibly wide range of organisms, including ones that thrive on substances that are usually poisonous.
So I wondered, could it be possible here on Earth that we might actually be able to find something? So we hedged our bets and we went to an arsenic-rich environment where the natural experiment may have been set up.
The arsenic-rich environment she picked was Mono Lake in California. It's a very odd lake, very salty, full of arsenic, and yet it's teeming with life, including lots of microscopic organisms in the muddy lake bed.
We went out to Mono Lake and gathered some mud, put that mud in a broth or a liquid where I've added a lot of arsenic and no phosphorus.
The idea was that only an organism that could live on arsenic would survive. She says in retrospect, the experiment was pretty bold.
As a young scientist, I thought, well, why not do this? The chances of it working are low, but if it works, it's very profound. So I took a sample and microscopically examined the sample of these test tubes, and sure enough, there were fast-swimming little bugs in there.
They were surviving on arsenic instead of phosphorus. And Wolf-Simon says other tests suggested that arsenic had even replaced some phosphorus in the organism's DNA, although not all. NASA officials lost no time hailing the result at a press conference in Washington. Mary Wojtek directs the agency's astrobiology program.
This is a phenomenal finding. We are talking about taking the fundamental building blocks of life and replacing one of them with another compound.
And that has implications for NASA's ongoing search for signs of life elsewhere in the universe. Pamela Conrad, an astrobiologist at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, says it could even affect the agency's work on Mars.
So, for example, on Mars Science Laboratory, if you had an environment that appeared to be rich in arsenic or some unanticipated metal, and you also had a finding of organic molecules, you could begin to put a picture together about what the environmental chemistry might portend.
In other words, whether there might be life. But other scientists are less impressed. They point out that the experiment did not eliminate all phosphorus from the bacterium and that the organism may still need some to survive. The findings appear in the journal Science. John Hamilton, NPR News.
The seafloor is another exotic habitat where life takes strange forms. In the Gulf of Mexico, some of that life is threatened by oil from BP's blown-out well. There's growing evidence that a good portion of that oil sank to the bottom and remains there. NPR's Richard Harris joined a scientist to get a look firsthand and sent us this audio postcard.
To get to the seafloor a few miles from the blown-out Macondo well, we clamber into a titanium-hulled submarine named Alvin and are gently hoisted off the deck of its mothership into a surprisingly blue and inviting Gulf of Mexico. Mike Skoronski is our pilot.
Roger the checks. Your launch altitude is 880 meters, 880. You have permission to dive when swimmers are clear.
Roger, swimmers clear, Alvin diving.
As we descend, the water turns from bright blue to cobalt, twilight to black. Samantha Joy and I press our faces to our tiny windows and watch as glowing animal life streams by. Very peaceful.
Yeah, that's why I like diving in the submarine. It's calm and quiet, and then you hit the bottom and you're like, wow.
Joy is from the University of Georgia, and she's trying to see what happened to all the oil that spewed from the BP well. As we reach the bottom, my first impression is, well, it's not here. Everything looks pretty normal.
Tons of fish on the bottom. I don't see any invertebrates in the sediments, but it's hard to say. Sometimes they hide. But there's definitely shrimp and critters crawling around on the sediments.
Some of the clams look happy as clams. But when the alvin scrapes the bottom, we discover we're not actually sitting on the usual dark gray mud that forms the seafloor.
There's oil on the bottom. If you look at the camera, you can see the brown coloration.
We see this brown stuff on coral fans hit like pine trees along a dusty dirt road. More slimy brown stuff hangs over some of the odd formations of frozen natural gas here, half a mile below the surface. Crabs here normally pick at worms that actually live in this methane ice.
The crabs don't look healthy. See all the dark spots and lesion-looking things? That's not normal.
It's impossible to say from this single dive how much this ecosystem is hurting. After all, many of these animals have evolved to live in or near natural seeps of oil and gas. And clearly, some of the routine commerce of undersea life is still taking place. Joy and other scientists will keep diving until they can flesh out this story. But as our questions mount, Alvin's batteries run down. It's time to drop our weights and leave this eerie world behind.
Reach up here, hold that down. That's it.
We are at 872 and all weights away. Over.
Over.
25 contemplative minutes later, we are back on the surface. Richard Harris, NPR News, on the research vessel Atlantis in the Gulf of Mexico.
For years now, there's been evidence that intestinal parasites can actually be a good thing for people suffering from inflammatory bowel disease. That's because certain parasitic worms seem to help the intestine heal. Now, scientists think they've found at least one reason why this is so, thanks to a man who spent years treating his own bowel disease with worms. NPR's John Hamilton has the story.
Peng Lok studies parasites. Years ago, when he was working at the University of California, San Francisco, he got a call from a stranger.
He had moved into the Bay Area and was looking for someone who works on worms, and so he called me and convinced me to have lunch with him.
Over lunch, the man told Lok a remarkable story about how he'd recovered from ulcerative colitis. It's a bowel disease in which the immune system appears to attack the lining of the colon, causing devastating ulcers. And for this man, the usual treatments, including steroids, hadn't helped.
So he was being faced with options of really severe immune suppressants or colectomy.
The doctors wanted to remove his colon. But this man was a young entrepreneur with his own ideas. He'd run across the work of a scientist named Joel Weinstock. Weinstock, who's at Tufts Medical Center in Boston now, had done something that seemed bizarre. He'd started treating people with ulcerative colitis using parasitic worms.
So people would swallow microscopic eggs. And the eggs then hatch within the GI tract, and that living agent comes out, is capable to interact with the host's immune system.
Weinstock thought these parasites might help because in parts of the world where they are common, inflammatory bowel disease is rare. And his hunch turned out to be correct. The people in his study got better. Lok says that was good enough for the entrepreneur in San Francisco, who started looking for his own source of parasitic worm eggs.
And he managed to find a parasitologist in Thailand who was willing to help him obtain these eggs, and then he infected himself.
He got better too, and he was feeling fine by the time he had lunch with Lok. But he wanted scientists to figure out why the cure had worked. So he offered to let researchers study his intestine over the next few years. During that time, the worms began to die off and the man's disease came back. So he took another dose of worm eggs and got better again. Through it all, Lok and his colleagues were collecting blood and tissue samples from the man.
And what we found was that after worm infection, the regions of the colon that were previously not making mucus was now making mucus again.
That's a key factor in healing. And it looked like the mucus came back because the worms were causing the body to produce a substance called IL-22. Weinstock says that makes sense.
This is a molecule that promotes epithelial growth and healing, and perhaps does other things to the immune system that would be potentially beneficial.
Weinstock says other studies suggest parasites can regulate the immune system in ways that prevent it from going wild and attacking healthy tissue. And he says it's likely that human evolution took that into account.
Humans have had parasites ever since we evolved from living in caves and or swinging from trees or however it used to be. And disrupting these relationships probably had consequences.
Weinstock says drug companies are now trying to create parasites that would actually be approved by the FDA for treating inflammatory bowel disease. These days, Loke is in New York at NYU Medical Center. He says the entrepreneur in San Francisco plans to keep himself infected with parasitic worms. The new research appears in the journal Science Translational Medicine. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Like many of us, after Thanksgiving, John Hamilton had food on his mind this week. Food is not a drug, but new research in animals shows that sweet or fatty foods can act a lot like a drug in the brain. And there's growing evidence that eating too much of these foods can cause long-term changes in the brain circuits that control eating behavior. Here's John's report.
If you've ever wondered why it's hard to stay on a diet, consider this observation from Ralph DeLeon, a brain scientist at Yale.
The motivation to take cocaine, in a case of a drug addict, is probably engaging similar circuits that the motivation to eat is in a hungry person.
DeLeon says that's what brain scientists have concluded after comparing studies of overeating with studies of drug addiction. He says those studies show that the wiring in our brains includes special pathways that make us feel good when we eat and really good when we eat sweet or fatty foods with lots of calories.
Drug addiction is really usurping or taking over, hijacking is what we usually say, some of these pathways that evolved to promote food intake for survival reasons.
DeLeon says that doesn't necessarily mean food is addictive the way cocaine is, but he says there's growing evidence that eating a lot of certain foods early in life can alter your brain. Teresa Reyes of the University of Pennsylvania showed that in an experiment with mice.
We gave mice a high-fat diet from the time that they were weaned until the time we studied them, which was at 20 weeks of age. And in that time, they gained significant amounts of weight and became obese.
Then Reyes and her team looked at the brain's pleasure centers, areas known to change in drug addiction.
And what we found is that in animals that were obese, there were really dramatic changes in these areas of the brain that participate in telling us how rewarding food is.
The changes made these areas less responsive to fatty foods, so an obese mouse would have to eat more fat than a typical mouse to get the same amount of pleasure. And Reyes says some of the changes didn't go away, even when the mice returned to a normal diet.
So it is similar to what happens in cases of chronic drug abuse. The reward circuitry changes in a similar way, and that promotes the seeking of that drug, or in our case, in seeking palatable food.
Reyes says that could help explain why obese children tend to remain that way as adults. More evidence of a link between food and drugs comes from a team that has been trying to understand how hunger can trigger an animal's craving for drugs.
Hungry animals will take a lot of drugs.
Uri Shalev is a researcher at Concordia University in Montreal. He and his colleagues studied rats that had learned to give themselves heroin by pressing a lever. When the scientists removed the heroin, the rats mostly stopped pressing the lever. But when the scientists also took away the rat's food, the lever pressing came back with a vengeance.
Even though they don't get the drug anymore, but they will go and they'll press the lever, and then this could be like hundreds of times.
Shalev's team thought this behavior might involve a substance in the brain called neuropeptide Y. It makes animals feel hungry. And sure enough, when hungry rats got a substance that blocks neuropeptide Y, they stopped pressing the lever. Plenty of other studies also have shown links between food and drugs. A Swedish team found that a stomach hormone called ghrelin could make rats seek sugar the way addicts seek drugs. And a team at the University of California, Santa Barbara, found that male rats chose sugar over small amounts of cocaine, while female rats did just the opposite. Even so, Ralph DeLeon from Yale says it's still not clear how far the food-drug comparison holds up, especially in people.
There's an ongoing argument in my field whether food's addictive or not. But something to keep in mind is whether it's addictive or not, there's probably components that are similar to addiction. And in the end, we probably have to use that information to try to deal with this problem.
DeLeon says that almost certainly means focusing on eating behavior early in life. He says it also could mean taking approaches used to treat addiction and adapting them to overeating. John Hamilton, NPR News.
And finally, a very different kind of food issue. The small African nation of Malawi has been celebrated in recent years as the scene of a modest green revolution. Corn harvests are up and hunger is down thanks to a government program that passes out cut-rate sacks of seed and fertilizer to farmers. But those subsidy programs are expensive, and people need more to eat than just corn. Many are saying farmers in Malawi and all over Africa should look beyond corn. Malawi is tucked into a corner of southeastern Africa, but when Sig Snap, an American agricultural scientist, arrived there in the early 1990s, she thought it looked pretty familiar.
It's a little like going to Iowa, and that you see corn everywhere, up the hillsides, down the hillsides.
Corn, or maize, is the main source of food in Malawi and across much of eastern and southern Africa.
Maize is life, is a saying in Malawi.
But corn is a demanding crop. It needs lots of fertilizer, and that can be expensive. Also, plenty of water. And Snap says corn may provide calories to keep you alive, but it doesn't have everything your body needs.
Even with gains in maize, it is just a starch. Children, to grow healthy, need a bit of oil and protein.
In fact, about a third of the people in Malawi have experienced malnutrition severe enough to stunt their growth. Snap was working with an international agricultural research center at the time, and she started looking for ways that farmers could add something else to their fields and to their meals. She thought about crops like peas or beans or peanuts. They don't deliver as much grain as corn does, but they contain precious protein. What's more, these crops, called legumes, actually make nitrogen fertilizer from air and replenish the soil for the next corn crop. So for the last 10 years, Snap and some colleagues in Malawi have been working with farmers all over the country who are willing to use some of their land to plant other crops. They tried lots of legumes, pigeon peas, peanuts, even one that's more like a tree. The researchers wanted to know if those crops were practical for farmers to grow.
We had to see which ones were profitable, which ones took less labor. Farm families in Africa are really labor-strapped.
Last week, the researchers published their results in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Snap is now at Michigan State University. She says the experiment confirmed her hopes. Farmers who planted some legumes got that bonus crop, plus they got more corn from that land the next year because the legumes made the soil more fertile. Snap says farmers liked growing pigeon peas best. Women farmers, in particular, were happy to grow a more nutritious crop.
Now it's starting to snowball. 50-some villages, 8,000 farm families are now doing this, some with, you know, minimal connection to the project. In other words, we're not providing seeds anymore.
So, problem solved? Maybe not for most farmers, says David Rohrbach, an agricultural economist in the World Bank's office in Malawi. African farmers do grow legumes or vegetables when they can, he says, but in places like Malawi, many have so little land they're afraid to. Survival comes first.
They're almost forced to put most of their land into their primary staple food, such as corn.
Rohrbach says he's more optimistic about a different approach. Find ways to grow more corn on each acre. If farmers are confident they can grow more than enough corn, they'll be willing to spare some land for crops that provide a healthier diet. And that's it for this week's On Science podcast. I'm Dan Charles. Thanks for listening.